Hello and welcome to The Wealth Chat, brought to you by SG Kleinwort Hambros. I'm Jonathan Speck, Senior Partner at Morant.
I'm Jonathan Needham, Head of Trust and Succession Planning for Societe Generale Private Banking.
And I'm Simon Kleiss, Head of Private Client Trust for SG Kleinwort Hambros.
In today's episode, we're talking about wealth planning. More importantly, what does good planning actually look like in practice?
Generally speaking, I will actually say to the gatekeepers, we can't do a proper job unless we have access to the family members. The family members, of course, have asked the gatekeepers to get the governance and the planning sorted out, and that's where the problem lies.
We went through the process of creating a family constitution and agreeing a new governance framework, and we reflected at the end with them, how has this experience been for you? And they said the experience has been really valuable because it's enabled us to communicate together. It's actually brought us together. It's made us communicate in a different way.
I think as you move through generations, the challenge for every family, it doesn't matter how wealthy one is or how wealthy one isn't, uniting around a purpose is really important.
To help us explore this, we are joined by Claire Sturzaker, a partner at Boodle Hatfield in London, and by Nick Jacob, a partner at Forsters in London. Nick specialises in succession planning and related legal and tax matters for multi-generational families and their offices. Claire deals with sophisticated private wealth planning, succession, protecting family businesses and avoiding family disputes. Nick, I'm interested in really good planning. That's why you're here. You're one of the most experienced lawyers practicing in this area around wealth planning. Do you have a philosophy for it?
It depends on whether people really understand what family governance is all about. A lot of people think it's purely succession planning, but it's actually much deeper than that. And getting down to the nuts and bolts of the families and the business psychology is a key element in working out how you're going to actually put together an arrangement for succession for the family, harmony within the family, and succession for the business. And I think it's really important to be able to have access to the individual family members who have influence and those who don't, but may have influence in the future. We'll talk about next gen a bit later, but the importance of understanding what the concerns are of particularly the younger generation, who often feel that they're not really taken into account, is really key to making sure that there is a clear path forward for them and that they feel they have the opportunity of becoming involved with the family. And it's during those discussions that you really work out what the fundamental issues are for those family members. It's amazing how they've all got issues that they want a mouthpiece to elaborate to. And unless they have that mouthpiece, you have the risk of significant disharmony in the future because you can't deal with the issues that may be starting to fester. If you can get those issues early, then you can deal with those during the course of a governance exercise in most cases and ensure suitable harmony for the future. And in that way, you should be able to avoid family battles, and we see lots of those around. They're fodder for lawyers, but they are very damaging both for the family and generally for the business. And if you can try and find a way through to protect both of those, then you are really achieving something. And that's, I think, the underlying philosophy of the sort of planning that one's talking about.
Can I pick up on a couple of points there? Because I want to make the best of this opportunity to quiz you. You said something that really matters to me, and it was access. One of my bugbears in dealing with wealthy clients is what I call gatekeepers, who can fudge the advice or misdescribe the advice or not communicate it effectively. Do you agree with that? Do you have issues with gatekeepers?
I agree 100%. It's a key issue. And generally speaking, I will actually say to the gatekeepers, we can't do a proper job unless we have access to the family members. Now, the family members, of course, have asked the gatekeepers to get the governance and the planning sorted out. And that's where the problem lies. And I think it's getting them to understand the psychological element of the work that one is doing. It's not purely a legal or a trust job. It's actually getting under the skin of those people. you're absolutely right. One has to get access to the people. There are times when one is asked to do a legal job by the gatekeeper, but generally speaking, I've found that that is far less successful as a decent job that actually deals with the family and the business issues than if you've actually got access to the individuals concerned. And certainly at next gen level, unless you can find out what their worries are, they will fester for years and in many cases end up in litigation, which is a disaster.
Well, it may be for them. Happily, litigation is great for me as a litigator, but let's focus on the planning side.
I was rather
things.
Conscious of that, Jennifer.
Thank you, Nick. Claire, you, like Nick, are an incredibly experienced expert lawyer specialising in this area. I was amazed to discover that Boodles is 300 years old. So clearly the partnership is getting something right. Do you buy into what Nick says about philosophy?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what Nick was referring to there is so important, in that creating space through governance structures for families to take a step back and think more deeply around their philosophy, around what it means to be a family and business together and to have created what they've created, is so critical. And certainly when we were reflecting on our legacy of 300 years, we wanted to hear from our clients around what legacy means to them right now. And what's really interesting is that a lot of families are absolutely seeking the opportunity to think deeply about this, particularly with the current problems that we're seeing in the world right now from a geopolitical risk perspective and also from an environmental perspective. And so are starting to question a bit more around, well, if we're leaving a business behind, if we're leaving wealth behind, what contribution is that making to society? What positive contribution is that making to society? And so are starting to frame legacy, I think, not just in terms of how do we pass this business down and it survive for the next generation, but also more, what's it about? Which I'm sure, you know, John will talk to in a moment when we're thinking about purpose, but it's definitely focusing on how can I make sure that what we've created here leaves a good footprint behind? Because if my legacy is to contribute to the problems of society, then that's really not helping anyone, particularly the next generation. So I think Nick's points around governance are really important in this context, because families need some time to have meetings together, to spend time with other external facilitators to really think this through more deeply and assess how they maybe want to look at transforming the ways in which they manage their business, their wealth, to effectively achieve a better societal outcome when it comes to thinking about their legacy.
And are you seeing, I hesitate to say a fashion, but a trend towards philanthropy, societal contribution and the bigger picture?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think, you know, throughout my career, philanthropy has always been there. I think certainly in the past 10 years, it has gained huge amounts of interest and traction in the UK market in particular. And that's definitely arising, I think, from some of the problems we're experiencing in our society right now, particularly on the back of COVID, you know, when there's a growing level of wealth inequality. And I think for many families we work with, they look at their position and the success they've had, and they're thinking, again, quite critically around how can we ensure that we're giving back to society and we're helping resolve some of the problems that we're facing at the moment. So philanthropy has gained a lot of interest. There are still some issues around families talking about it, thinking about it, but still not doing enough to move the needle on giving. And that's a separate point. But I think certainly philanthropy has become a much bigger focus of the legacy discussions.
I think it's actually interesting how ESG has also triggered a lot of that, where businesses and families feel guilty that they've exhausted the earth's supply of certain elements and they want to give back in the way you say. So I think that's becoming a much more common scenario than it used to be.
Yeah, we're certainly seeing businesses where maybe the next gen in part have driven some of this focus, but certainly current gen are now more critically looking at their business and assessing it through that ESG lens. So actually looking at how the impact the business has on the environment and how that can be improved, thinking about the contribution that business is making to society, and then really assessing the governance framework and how well that business represents the society in which it operates. So, yeah.
How much do you think your clients care about how is this playing out in the public domain?
There's definitely an element of that for many, I think. There has to be, because you have to have an eye on what do your stakeholders think of you, and more broadly, what does your public profile look like? So I think that does play a role. But I think for people to really do this properly, it takes a lot of effort and time. And so those who are really focused on this are not doing it just to gain some good public PR. They're doing it because they really deeply believe in it. And I think there's that obvious example recently of the Patagonia business, where the family have been totally committed to dealing with environmental issues and climate change.
This is the clothing.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you give us a few pointers?
Yeah, sure.
That?
So, I mean, that's been fascinating in that they've looked at how they, well, from the start, really, they've been very focused on how their business can effectively operate in a very sustainable way. You know, they produce outdoor clothing. The fashion industry, you know, contributes a lot to the environmental problems that we have right now. And they're very carefully thinking through how do we make sure we operate really sustainably when it comes to producing our garments and selling them. But also the family have been thinking through their ownership structure and have effectively reached the decision that they're placing the bulk of their shares into a trust which will contribute towards climate change research and activism. And so effectively have given away a lot of their wealth to deal with those issues. So right from the top all the way down, they're really trying to transform how they operate and leave a positive footprint in society.
The other angle on that, though, is reputation management, where families are concerned, particularly through the dangers of social media, of being damaged by comments made on social media. And I think we're dealing much more with reputation management than we ever were, and trying to prevent certain information which may be misinterpreted getting to the public domain. And it's becoming a really big issue for many high-profile families.
I'm hearing that there's an awful lot to think about when you sit down and try to analyse what's involved in really good planning. And what I'm hearing from the two of you is just how important purpose, values, and so on is. John, I know this is one of your bugbears. What would you add to this? Tell us about your experience of advising families.
It is really important. You know, I've dealt with many families over many years, and many have different attitudes, and attitudes do change over time and also across generations. So it's somewhat a movable feast. But I think the biggest thing for me that happened was actually the financial crisis back in 2008. That caused the paradigmal shift in the people's attitudes towards wealth, because I think the financial crisis at the time, the wealthy were very much regarded as being part of the problem rather than the solution. So there was this need to alter their public persona and the way they're perceived in public. And also, you know, wealthy families have always been very philanthropic, going back way back even to Victorian times. But they've done it largely below the radar. I think that also changed as a result of the crisis in 2008, which is where people really started to give, not just financially, because I think simply making a donation has become unattractive to many because they don't know where the money ends up or how it gets spent. They spend a lot more time now being engaged in, well, how can we contribute to this process? Not by just financially supporting it, but supporting it in other tangible ways, i.e. expertise and participation. And that expertise and participation comes from them and their families. So that's a slightly different view of the world of philanthropy. And the sort of sleeves up approach, as I regard it, is something that is very good because it has a very positive influence, not so much from, you know, the public view of them, which is important in terms of reputation and et cetera, but actually as a basis on which to unite a family around a vision and purpose is very powerful because I think as you move through generations, the challenge for every family, it doesn't matter how wealthy one is or how wealthy one isn't, uniting around a purpose is really important. Because uniting around a purpose and vision is very helpful in terms of ensuring at an individual level amongst family members, there is an environment of transparency and trust. Because they have to work together on these projects, they have to be open with each other, and that level of engagement, and also having the more difficult discussions around how they deal with wealth going forward is really important. And people shouldn't shy away from it, irrespective of what level of wealth they have, because it's just relative to you in a particular set of circumstances. And having that discussion, for me, helps define the vision and purpose. It provides a point of unity which the family can hook onto and actually forms the basis of a more sustainable wealth transition and transfer moving forward that is not simply about the financial piece, it's also about the societal piece, and that's equally important.
It's interesting you talk about that, the purpose, which I think is much easier
in a philanthropic environment to identify. We struggle with many families in deciding what their overall overriding purpose is. And they talk about priorities and various different aspects, but that's one thing that they do find quite difficult, unless it's for a philanthropic purpose, which is much easier. Mm. So that's a really difficult area for many families, but I agree with you. If they've got a clear purpose, it helps enormously.
The points that I'm, again, taking from this really good debate are unity, harmony, environment of trust, sustainability. Those are really great buzzwords, but as ever, how do we put the pen to paper and legislate for it? And I know from knowing you over the years, Nick, that one thing that you're really strong about is family constitutions, family governance. Can that help provide a framework to put this kind of theoretical idea into solid practice?
Yes, it certainly can help if it's done in the right way. The problem often is that people feel they need a constitution and they ask for a precedent. And there is no precedent because every family is different, every business is different, the way they operate is different. And for one example that I'm working on at the moment is somebody drafted a constitution for a family I'm working with 12 years ago. It was 56 pages long. God knows how much they paid for it, but they put it in the bottom drawer and they've never looked at it since. And they showed it to me and they said, what should we do with this? And I said, well, this is actually useless. It's so complicated, it's so convoluted, and nobody's actually read it since. So we're now reducing 50-odd pages down to 8 or 9 of key points that they actually want to implement and that will help them to maintain harmony and unity and all the things that you've just said. And they're really buying into those things because we've discussed them and we're now going to put them in writing. But the other point, which is key in this is not a document that is just drawn up and put in the bottom drawer. It has to be a living, breathing document which is reviewed every year in one respect or another so that younger members will buy into it, will understand what it's for, and will be able to utilise it effectively. It may need reviewing and changing over the course of time, but it does need to be focused on a way of working that actually encapsulates the key points for the family. And again, coming back to the psychology that I talked about, unless you can understand the psychology of that family, you can't really enshrine what you want to have in a constitution or charter, it doesn't matter what you call it, in a way that's going to be meaningful for people. So it does have a real value, but it has to be done in the right way and it has to be reviewed and used and not just forgotten about. In the same way that any other document you might do for governance purposes. I mean, one of the other things we often do where you've got different shareholders of the business, trustee shareholders, individual shareholders, corporate shareholders, is put a shareholders agreement together because that provides a framework for younger generation members to come into the family business and understand how it's structured and what opportunities they have. It restricts the ability to transfer shares to people where you don't want to transfer shares. The process of a constitution and agreement like that is really the value almost more than what's written down on the piece of paper.
I totally agree with that. Because I think actually when I worked with a family a few years ago, we went through the process of creating a family constitution and agreeing a new governance framework. And we reflected at the end with them, how has this experience been for you? And they said the experience has been really valuable because it's enabled us to communicate together. It's actually brought us together. It's made us communicate in a different way. And the outcome, having the constitution and other governance tools, is really important, but it was more the process that was valuable for us. And I think for many families, that remains the case.
Brought to mind a family that I dealt with, and they dealt with it in a very similar fashion, actually, in terms of the founder of the family business decided that the way to address that was creating different share classes within the shareholder agreement. So the voting rights actually attributed directly to family members rather than non-family members. So his big bugbear was actually not just maintaining the wealth of the family, but maintaining the engine room of that wealth for generations to come, where they could be in absolute control of their own destiny to some degree as far as the business was concerned. And it is very useful. It doesn't necessarily apply to everybody, but I think it, in the context of planning and what does good really look like, giving some serious thought to these things has to be done, because if you don't, you're going to reach a situation where very quickly everyone could be shooting in the dark, which is not a good place to be.
And I think this is certainly the big question that I come across, you know, a lot, John, is when is it, you know, that you sort of bring that next generation into knowing about, you know, the family wealth? And I don't honestly think there's a right answer to that, and there's probably no right time. So what I find myself often doing, you know, when speaking to clients is, I guess, a lot of probing, you know, with the sort of patriarch or matriarch, the wealth creator, to say, look, when do you want to start? Or how much, you know, does that next generation know about that wealth? What involvement do you want them to have? When is the right time, you know, to do that? And then how do we do it then is the important part. So for me, I find that is often a topic of most, say, meetings that I have with clients, where I guess the next generation are coming to adulthood. You know, they've enjoyed probably a great lifestyle. They perhaps don't know the extent of the wealth that lies behind the family. If you don't have those conversations and they leave it too long, you know, it sort of manage the sort of unexpected thing that might happen, because it's proven it does, you know, it does happen. And that's where you start getting into conflict. The other thing, I was going back on some of the philanthropic and charitable sort of side of things. You know, in quite a few cases, I found that the family line has come to an end. So who is left to benefit? And I think that's where certainly I've probably had most involvement with, where that family line has come to an end. And really trying to get back to what the wealth creator really would have wanted, what was close to his heart, you know, in terms of those sort of charitable and philanthropic ideas and how we sort of manage that. So,
Really interesting point, that, because I don't come across that quite so often. It's normally the family's growing exponentially. But one of the issues that comes off what Jonathan was saying was the issue of non-family members getting involved in the business. And that may well be what would happen if the family actually dies out. And I think a lot of families struggle with how they will treat, in terms of voting power, if any, and remuneration, both the family members and the non-family members, because you get situations where family members think they're taken for granted, not paid very well, and could do far better outside the family business. Then key non-family members who are paid very well, because otherwise they wouldn't join. And then that creates friction within the family members. And then the non-family members think, well, I'm pretty influential here, but I ain't got a vote. And so how do we deal with that? And those issues I'm finding coming up more and more, which would be relevant to your situation about family dying out, but is also relevant to how you bring in the family members into the business and how you capture the good people and how you tell the not so good people they're not good enough, which is another challenge.
And more importantly, you should never appoint a family member to your business if they have no aptitude for the business whatsoever.
Well, I think that's a real difficulty. And you know, telling somebody he's not up to it or she's not up to it is going to create friction within the family.
Somebody once said to me, Jonathan, you've been given one mouth and two ears for a reason. Use them in that proportion. And I'm trying to do that today. But one of the things I'm listening to you about is the really important skill in a good planner of listening. And that's really come through in everything that you've said, because listening is one of the most important aspects of communication. And I'm, Claire, really interested to hear from you as an expert lawyer in this field. You talk, I know, about the importance of transparency, openness, engagement, as opposed to what I call the culture of fear, fearing what might happen and planning it around. How do you deal with that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's really interesting, because I think fear plays a big part in our work, and it's quite helpful in many respects, if we're completely honest, because if clients are fearful of what may happen and fearful of how to handle things, they will invariably seek advice. But at the same time, I think there's an interesting kind of debate emerging at the moment in the family business space and succession space around, actually, is it right to predicate a lot of what we talk about on fear? There's the often cited quotation that, you know, many family businesses don't survive beyond the third generation. And recently that research has been questioned and challenged. And actually, apparently it was based on a study of farmers in Illinois in America. And that was the scope of the study, but it's been used very widely globally for all family businesses. And I don't know the extent to which that's a fair challenge. But anyway, the challenge is there, that maybe is this statistic completely correct? But it's certainly something we've all traded off. And I think we often talk to families around, if you don't do this, this is the risk of what would go wrong. And I think more people are saying, actually, it would be potentially more constructive to focus on what are the benefits to approaching this in a more open and transparent way? How do we kind of try and dial down your concerns from a fear-based perspective and focus on actually what are the positive benefits of starting to talk much more openly about the wealth, about your plans for the wealth, and giving particularly the next generation much more support to deal with that? But it's quite a new way of looking at things, I would say, in many respects, because we've all had clients throughout our careers who operate on the basis of the more control I have, the more I can control from the grave, the better things will be. And I think this approach is suggesting that actually maybe dialing down some of that control and thinking more openly about how you communicate with your next generation about what the wealth structures will look like in the future and what their expectations should be is a better place to start from. So yeah, I am an advocate of that, but you have to really recognise the psychology of the family you're working with, as Nick has said earlier, because in some families in certain parts of the world, that's very difficult to do. And it takes a lot of sort of coaching and advisory conversations to work out how they begin to do that in a way that feels comfortable for them.
Well, I wasn't aware of the farmers in Illinois, but actually there was a study, I think, done by, I think it was EY, 7, 8, maybe 9 years ago on family businesses in Europe. And actually the conclusion was that over 50% of businesses in Europe are family businesses. So that's a big number. Arguably, BMW is a family business at its heart, so that's a good example. The other point they made was actually less than 5% of those family, I think it's less than 5% of those family businesses, certainly less than 10, actually transition to the third generation. Now, some of that is for good reasons, because they have liquidity events and have been highly successful, and they've moved on to a different project or period. But actually, quite a lot is down to the fact that they actually just fail. And actually the stewardship, the correlation between the stewardship of a family business and the stewardship of family wealth is frankly one. So they are strongly correlated. And actually when you do your planning, particularly if you're an entrepreneur, you can't just simply focus on one element. You have to operate and think about the two elements in parallel and the relationships between the two. Now, those relationships, as Nick said, may be at the shareholder level, they may be at the employee level, they may be at both. But operating and thinking about the two things and that journey that you're going to undertake and looking at the two things in parallel is really, really important. Because if you only do one, it's not going to work.
Can I ask one question of Nick? Because as I listen to you guys, what is really important is having this good plan. But that's all very well if it's not adhered to. How do you best get family members to engage with the plan and to use an expression I don't really like, but I think you know what I mean, to own the plan? You've had, what, 40 years of experience of dealing with this, Nick. How do you do it?
I'd use a slightly different word from own. I'd say buy in to the plan. But it's a very good question, because that goes back to the root of what I was talking about, is understanding what the individuals feel and want. And very often, the younger generation won't understand enough about the business and the way it's structured and the way it needs to develop into the future. I was dealing with a family who had a logistics business, for example, which had been very successful, but clearly is now overtaken by modern technology. And the older generation didn't see that. The younger generation were incredibly frustrated by the fact that they could see this was going nowhere and the business was going to go belly up, because the older generation weren't focusing on the modern technology. So we suggested the young generation did a project over a 9-month period as to how they thought this business needed to develop in the future, by educating them about what the business was all about and the business structures, and then saying to them, a lot of these things are outmoded and we need to develop into the future. What do you advocate this business to do? Now, that was a great way of getting them fully involved and fully immersed in the business. And that is what happened. And the older generation just faded away. And that business became much more successful than it would ever have been. So they bought in, they owned that philosophy. Now, that's easier with that sort of business. The other way is to make sure that you are engaging with all generations in a way that allows them to feel comfortable with what the planning process is and the plans are. Now, you can't always get unanimity. If you've got 40 or 50 family members, you never will get unanimity.
And then you work out what are the aspects that are agreed on, what are the aspects that are disagreed on, and then focus on how you get people to either agree to disagree or get to a landing where they can all accommodate each other. Or you have some parts of the family who may exit. Providing a suitable exit route is another really important aspect of allowing the family to remain harmonious. One or two families won't allow that. That's where culture often comes in, because Eastern culture often will say, no, you're in it for life, and the next generation's in it for life as well. But exits are really important. But I think it is going through that process of allowing them a voice that allows them to buy in when they can see that their voice is being taken into account. And that's really key, and it gets people much more involved at all levels.
Well, maybe I could sum that up by saying you need to have a plan. You ought to have a good plan, but it's no good if it's ours, it's got to be yours. That's it for today's episode, the last one in the series. Thanks very much to our sensational guests, Claire Sturzaker and Nick Jacob, and to you for listening.
Hopefully this series has helped to answer some of the questions you may have had about succession planning and wealth transfer, or as I call it, the good, the bad and the indifferent.
If you'd like to find out more or have specific questions, do not hesitate to contact the SG Kleinwort Hambros private client team.
Goodbye.